When someone you love, deeply love and admire, and they've had a huge impact in your life, is taken by addiction, you're watching them, but just a shadow of them. It's like you're watching the shadow person. It's kind of looks like your person. They look like and they sound like, at times they can even be like the person you remember. But then you're met with this majority of the time where they're just awful. They're just awful. And you feel like they're gone. And you know intuitively that you need to recognize that and move on. But what happens is they'll show you something again, just for a moment. And it's like you get sucked back into it.
Yeah.
And the result of that, from a grieving standpoint, is that you're never able to really move on.
No, it hinders it.
You get frozen in it.
Right.
You get frozen. And I've been frozen in this for, how long has it been? Welcome back to another episode of Till the Wheels Fall Off. I'm Matt.
I'm Paige.
We've got an episode on grief in store today. It is long overdue.
Yep.
We've been dragging our feet on this one. It's been requested more times than I can count now.
Mm-hmm.
And we should have done it sooner, so apologies for that. Before we get there, let's get some announcements out of the way. First things first, we mentioned it last week. We are going to have some meetups this summer.
Yay!
And probably a workshop as well.
Yep.
For sure in the North Texas area, DFW. And then we're looking at a few other cities around the country. It's a lot of planning and we're not used to doing this, so we're trying to figure it out. I got online to try to start to plan this thing.
Yeah.
And got about 10 minutes in until I found my first hitch. And I'm like, oh, I don't have time for this right now.
Yeah.
I'll get back on it.
Yep.
So be on the lookout for that. Follow our social accounts. We'll announce it in the community as well. And if you're not already in the community, if you wonder what we're talking about when we talk about the community, we have a safe space for spouses and partners and people in recovery for more than a year to come share, process, vent, whatever you want to do. Ask questions, get feedback from others going through the same thing. It's totally free. It's called TUFO Community. You can find it by clicking the link in any of our social media profiles.
And we host Zoom calls occasionally as
well.
Oh,
we do?
Yeah.
Yeah, we've got one coming up soon.
Yes.
Yeah. Those are fun. I wish we could do more of them.
I know.
It's just crazy.
It's hard.
It's crazy. We have like full-time jobs outside of this, so...
Well, this is my full-time job plus the kids.
Yeah. So, and I have a job outside of this too. So it's just,
yeah.
It's crazy. We do the absolute best we can.
Yeah.
We still got merch available on tufo.com. We've still got some sweatshirts. It is still chilly in most of the country. Winter is not done yet. And even when it does get warm, is there anything better than cuddling up with a sweatshirt? Not much. Have you seen the anxiety decreasing sweatshirts?
I have not.
You didn't look those up today?
No.
They're crazy. So I think it's a marketing gimmick, but there are companies that sell sweatshirts and they claim to reduce anxiety.
I just want to know what kind of material they use. Like, is it super tight? Because I don't like tight stuff on me.
No, it's super fluffy. It's like oversized, like streetwear style.
Is it weighted?
I don't know.
Like a weighted blanket sometimes brings less anxiety, or whatever dogs wear, whenever there's Thunder Buddy thing.
Thunder
or whatever.
Buddy shirts that dogs wear.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know the story behind it.
I have to look into it because it's quite interesting.
And I'm not going to claim that our sweatshirts decrease anxiety
by any means.
But you will be repping the movement that is getting you through some really tough times, supporting creators like us. And they're really comfy, like legitimate comfy.
Yeah, they're great.
I love wearing them.
And they wash well too.
Yeah, we got stickers available on there.
Feel the feels.
Speaking of stickers, someone got a free TUFO water bottle this last week.
On the airplane.
I left a bottle on the airplane with a TUFO sticker on it.
It still blows my mind that you did that, because that's not a Matt move. That would be a mom move, because I would be so busy dealing with all the other crap.
Well, that's exactly how it happened.
Yeah.
Went to go watch baseball in Arizona, spring training baseball with our son. And I was so concerned with what he was leaving on the plane. Mm-hmm. You know, like he's got this like earbuds, that's a movie, not the dog. Earbuds.
AirPods.
Yeah. So I was worried about him leaving those and like cleaning up the trash so he didn't leave a bunch of trash behind. Anyway, I just ended up leaving it.
I think it's interesting that you got a taste of that. And you can understand
how
easy
it
is to just lose things.
Just like that. But speaking of water, it was a Stanley water bottle. So someone got a free Stanley water bottle.
I was hoping that somebody would see the sticker and like Google it and say, hey, I found your water bottle. But like you said, it was a good water bottle.
Never
so
know.
No,
we could have gotten a listener
that.
From it. I don't know.
I don't know either.
Someone saw it and was like, what is this? Or maybe they saw it and like, these two are crazy. What is this crap? No telling.
That's a possibility.
Just took the sticker off and stole the Stanley.
Yeah.
Speaking of Stanleys, we've got a giveaway going on. Our first giveaway.
Yay!
I wrote a poem a while back, and it's on our blog, I believe. Mm-hmm. I could be lying. If it's not on our blog, it's definitely pinned in the community.
It is in the community. And I want to say I posted it on social media at some point, but I don't remember.
First of all, don't judge me on my poetry. I'm not.
Whatever. Can you
I'm
stop?
Not a writer. I'm
you
not a poet.
You are a writer.
I don't know the rules of poetry or writing necessarily. I just like to write. It's like a stream of consciousness. It's cathartic for me.
But it's a beautiful poem. And every time I read it, or as you say, I don't think it's a poem. I cry. He makes me tear up. It's really, really good.
I choked up the entire time writing it. Like, it was just from the heart, from the soul. And it was a letter, sort of a letter to you and our daughter. Mm-hmm. And it was also to just Wheelies. I was thinking of people in just really tough situations and what I would say to them. And it's called There's a Fire Inside. And the end of the poem is actually engraved on a new Stanley, not stolen.
I'm glad you clarified that. It's like a baby pink.
It's a 40-ounce Stanley. Which are totally crazy popular right now.
Yeah.
So we're going to be giving one away to a Wheelie with the most engagement in the group.
Yeah. Because not only when you engage in the group are you helping others, you're helping yourself through your own healing process.
Yeah.
And we're going to discuss even more of that. What with the grief topic that we have,
there's
going
a reason
today.
For it. There's a method to the madness. It's not just so you see more of it and mm-mm. so you get more invested in like what we're selling or anything like that.
No,
it's just for your recovery.
Yeah,
it's just for your recovery. It's very beneficial to be part of a community and to give back in acts of service. Doing selfless things helps you. Mm-hmm. It's the same. Like, this is the reason I volunteer treatment centers
exactly.
and talk to people in recovery all the time. Yeah. It's the same thing.
It's powerful.
Yeah. So. It's not just about the quantity of posts. Mm-mm. It's all about the quality of posts.
Exactly. Yeah. We're watching.
Yeah. We're watching.
Yeah.
We're watching.
We're paying attention.
So for the month of March, that's how we're going to be. That's our giveaway. We're going to be gauging it from. Did I say that right? Gauging it from engagement in the group. Mm-hmm. So be on the lookout for that. If you don't know about it, I think it's posted to our TikTok. It's also posted to the community. It's pinned in the community.
Yep.
So be on the lookout for that.
Yep.
Last thing, we've got courses still available. Our mini course is available. The Relationship Evaluation mini course, available for a limited time for $50. It is an excellent overview of what's going on in your life. We will get into some more of this as we talk about some of the things associated with grief in this episode. It's really tough to get a bird's eye view about what's going on, what the reality of your life is like. I do something very similar when I work with alcoholics and addicts. I did the same thing. You do like a step one practice, which is like, let's sort of look at everything. Let's look at the history of it all. Let's sort of get a glimpse of what's really happening here. Mm-hmm. And it's a very, very good way to sort of break the ice on like what's beginning in the recovery, recovering process. Step one, and it's available for a limited time, as well as the full course. It's available too.
Yep.
It's still out there. You can get 75% off using the code WHEELIES75. Again, that's WHEELIES with an S. 75. And that concludes our announcements for today.
Yeah. Thank awesome. You, dear. I appreciate it.
Let's talk grief.
Okay. So this topic has been brought up a lot within the community. We've even had people message us and I don't know why we haven't really discussed it. I think it's just something that's been on the back burner for a while.
I know we've talked about it in passing before.
Yes.
And it's really common to feel like you're mourning mm-hmm. in some ways. Mm-hmm. And you are.
Yeah, you are. So there's actually two types of grief that we're going to touch on. This is something we learned recently, and it was a huge aha moment for us. And I think that once we got a grasp on it, this is like, it's bumping us up a little bit too.
You know what's crazy though, is that when people hear what we're about to talk about, intuitively, they're going to know exactly what we're talking about.
Oh yeah.
Because everyone feels it. They just didn't know how to define it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So let's just talk about regular grief.
Standard grief.
Standard just grief, which typically happens, you know, when there's death, somebody close to you dies.
Or an animal,
loss of a pet, loss of a job.
Mm-hmm. Loss of a relationship.
There's like stages to this, which is denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance.
Those are like the five stages
of
grief.
Those are the five stages
of grief.
Have
been around forever.
And it makes sense because there's a stopping point with these types of situations.
Generally, yeah.
Yeah, like there's a date where everything changes.
Like this is when
this
the
is
bad
when
thing happened.
Something happened that was really difficult. And coping with this type of grief takes time. Like it's not linear. It's not the, you don't go in that,
it's like not that a perfect order. Science.
It's not a perfect science, but you do go through all of the motions and eventually time will help you get through it. And, you know, maybe going through therapy or, having a support group or something like that. It's just, it's simplified. There's a lot of articles out there on grief, and I actually have a link that I can, post to the notes section that I send to people that I work with that are dealing with regular grief. Do you have anything to tell
me? No, I write down notes so I don't cut you off. I'm trying to turn over a new leaf.
Okay, thank you. But that's all I have on regular grief right now. Do you have anything to add to it?
No, I was going to say, I think that regular grief, like we've all been there before, like when someone passes away, and it can be, I think, distinguished differently from what we're about to talk about. Mm-hmm. From the, there's this element of finality and closure. Like when someone passes away, there's that moment where they're gone, and you will know in some way whether or not you're there when it happens. Doctors might tell you, you get a phone call. There's that moment when you can like see in your mind, like this is when the world changed.
Yeah.
On this day at this time, mm-hmm. and things aren't the same anymore. Mm-hmm. And you're introduced to that. Like that's the beginning of the grief process, is when you get the news and it just hits you like a ton of bricks. Like, oh my God, they're gone, or it's gone, or we split up, whatever it might be. I was fired. You name it. And there's generally like rituals involved that help with this.
Right.
Like a funeral. Think of a funeral uh-huh. as a ritualistic way of the grief, like dealing with the closure of the grief process. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, like let's say that someone's lost a husband, like the widow is there. They've got the support of the community and their family. There are certain prayers that are said. There's a celebration of life. There's a burial. And they put dirt on top, flowers on top of the dirt. And like, you know, like in this moment, like they are gone.
Yeah.
They are gone.
And when it comes to like divorce or whatnot, you have papers that are signed. You're legally not.
You move out of the house.
Like there are things that have to happen. And it's in stone in a way. You know,
yeah.
Like it's just, there's a date there.
Yeah. Like when you split up, mm-hmm. there's like a date. Like we split up. I mm-hmm. moved out. We stopped talking. You know, she got the dog, I got the cat. Like
yes.
it's like we've gone on different paths now.
Yes.
And I think it makes sense in the context of grief. And so when a partner or spouse of an alcoholic or an addict is feeling this way, they're feeling grief, but there's no finality to this. Mm-hmm. There's no finality because they're still there.
Yes.
They're still there. And so I think that's whenever like people get confused, and not myself included. Like I'm grieving and I know I'm grieving, but when I read about grief, it just doesn't quite hit the same.
No, there's a lot of questions that go on within it. There's something else.
So what is that?
So
something else.
This is complicated grief, which comes from ambiguous loss. And we had just learned about this, which I just thought was really interesting to
yeah.
me. It was amazing. And it's grieving someone that's still alive. And this is where many wheelies are at. There isn't a clear outcome. You know, like we typically crave closure because our brains are wired to analyze information in our environment. And you're grieving the person you once knew or what could have been. You know, this can happen in addiction, mental illness, dementia. And it's loss of emotional connection when a person's physical presence remains, or when the emotional connection remains, but a physical connection is lost. So that would be like if, you know, someone was kidnapped or lost at sea or something
like
that.
Yeah,
like
soldiers missing in action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's just not a sense of closure. You may have intense sorrow, numbness, bitterness, persistent longing, pain, guilt, and anger. And these stages are similar to regular grief, but we get stuck or frozen in the stages.
Yes.
That's where it's a little different than regular grief. And during this time, we can also feel kind of ignored or misunderstood because people think grief only comes from physical loss.
Yeah.
So when you try to talk to somebody about the way you're feeling, it just doesn't connect or click because they're like, well, you're still with this person. So why are you so upset?
And people might be gentle for a bit, mm-hmm. but eventually they get frustrated and they're starting to tell you like, just get over it.
Yeah.
It's time to move on.
Yes. Like, which is
they lose their patience.
That's dangerous within our healing journey. When somebody says that to us.
Very, mm-hmm. very.
It is not constructive at all.
I think that spouses and partners of alcoholics, addicts, people that are lost in addiction have more in common with caretakers of Alzheimer's or dementia patients or mm-hmm. like family members. Like if you have a mother who like my grandmother is gone. Like mentally she's gone, but she's still here.
Yeah.
And there's grieving associated with that. And you can't, it's like you can't move past it because she's right there. I'm looking at her. She's right there.
Yeah.
When she looks in my eyes, like I see her, but she doesn't recognize me. Mm-hmm. So you're stuck in this, like, it's like frozen grief. It is. And it persists. And you mentioned complicated grief, which is distinguished from normal grief. It's a, I don't know, it's kind of a really simple scientific name, complicated versus normal.
Yeah.
I was like, what is this term? And looked into it more and more and more. It's prolonged grief with that.
No closure.
Grief, a lot of times, like I was reading a study, grief a lot of times lasts about 6 months. Mm-hmm. Longer than that, it starts to fall into this area we call complicated grief. And it's rather interesting. In terms of addiction, like, you know how some people say it's almost like they're addicted to the insanity of being in a relationship with someone? We talked about trauma bonds.
Well, yeah. And some people function better in chaos because they're so addicted to it, as you say.
Yeah. The roller coaster of being in a relationship with an alcoholic or an addict is addicting in some ways, whether or not we'd like to admit it, because there are these low lows. Mm-hmm. And then at your lowest moment, they show up and they act right and you get high.
Yep.
You get high from it.
You get that dopamine kick just like they get.
And this has been shown in scientific studies and brain imaging to happen with people in complicated grief, long-term grief like this. They will show photos of someone's loved one who's dealing with normal grief and parts of the brain that light up with memories and things like that. But when they show photos to someone in complicated grief, the reward center of the brain lights up. So dopamine kicks, like all this stuff is taking place. It's almost, it's like an addiction.
Yes.
Like you're drawn back to it. And people with the past of substance abuse, so past substance abuse whenever during their lives, are more susceptible to complicated grief as well, which is interesting. We got personal story about that here in a bit.
Well, that was next on here. I wanted you to kind of go into it.
Okay, so.
Because you do have that mentality. It was when we were discussing this, I was like, whoa.
That explains.
It did.
So I want to preface what we're about to get into in the rest of this conversation by saying, it was never and never has been our intention to show people how to leave relationships. That's not what we started doing. We wanted to educate people, validate people, empower people, and show people that there was a way to recover collaboratively. Like, mm-hmm. You and I did this together.
Yes.
Unfortunately, that's just not going to be the case for most people.
Yes.
Most people aren't going to be able to do that because one partner is not going to choose that growth path.
Right.
They're going to stay stuck.
Yeah.
They're going to remain in that.
It takes two.
It takes two. It takes two. So it's never been our intention just to show people how to leave a relationship. And so you might be wondering, well, how do they know so much about all this? Well, okay. So Paige isn't the only person I love in my life. I'm not the only person that she loves in hers. I've mentioned in the past that I have loved and been very close to many addicts.
Yes.
In my life.
Yes.
Very, very close to some people. I was raised in a home with addiction. You know, I've got siblings, some are sober, some are not. It's been a part of my life forever. So I'm very, very, very aware of what it takes to work through complicated grief, ambiguous loss. I've been doing this for most of my life.
Yeah.
In some way, shape, or form.
Right.
It's tough to talk about. Like, I'm just going to have to sit here for a minute. When someone you love, deeply love and admire, and they've had a huge impact in your life, is taken by addiction, you're watching them, but just a shadow of them. It's like you're watching the shadow person that's kind of looks like your person. They look like and they sound like, at times they can even be like the person you remember. But then you're met with this majority of the time where they're just awful. They're just awful and you feel like they're gone. And you know intuitively that you need to recognize that and move on. But what happens is they'll show you something again, just for a moment. And it's like you get sucked back into it.
Yeah.
And the result of that, from a grieving standpoint, is that you're never able to really move on.
No, it hinders it.
You get frozen in it.
Right.
You get frozen. And I've been frozen in this for, how long has it been? Decades?
Yeah.
Decades, you know?
Like, yeah.
Forever, for as long as I can remember, I've been in this with someone that I love dearly, someone very, very close to me. And, you know, it's only within the last 3 years that I was really able to recognize it. And I can remember the date now. Like, I remember when it happened and it's all hit me. And I'm like, holy crap. Like, I'm going to have to learn how to deal with this in a different way. This isn't like normal grief. Like, I know this person's gone. They're never going to understand. They're never going to see what I see. They're never going to change. Like, I had to get rid of the hope there. I had to stop hoping against hope that they were going to change, because if evidence shows me anything, it's that they won't.
Right.
And I know what it took to change, because I've done it myself, and they're not doing any of those things.
No.
And like, knowing what I know about recovery and addiction, I've done it. I've helped others do it. I've seen it happen. It was a little bit easier for me to see that they weren't doing those things, but it was still just as hard to come to terms and accept it.
Yeah.
Like, so effing hard.
Yeah.
So I know what it's like to leave an addicted relationship, mm-hmm. and one that you would never dream you would ever have to leave.
Yeah.
You know, something very, very close to me that maybe we'll talk about like in like clear details at a future date. I'm just not ready to do it yet.
Same.
It's tough though. It's tough, but we've been there. So, yeah. And Paige and I have been together for over 20
Since
years.
We were 14.
So this person's very close to her too.
Part of me as well. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, what's been your experience with all this? Because you've, like, a lot of your therapy dealt with this very thing.
Yeah. And my, I got through it not quicker, but before you. I was able to recognize it a lot easier than you were. But obviously it wasn't like as close of a relationship. I was able to detach a little bit easier, but I still had a lot of grief that went along with it, because I still recognized the good stuff. You know, there were good times, there were good things, there were great things, you know, and it became a point where it's like you question a lot. I went through all of the grief process with it. I did. It took years. And now I'm a little bit more clear headed on it, but we both do have experience with how this feels.
Yeah. So if you ever wonder how we know so much about this.
Yeah.
It's been my entire life.
Yeah.
Grief and loss and recovery and empowerment has been my life and yours too.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we've been there before, man. I can just tell you that, it's okay. It's okay if you're not moving as fast, as quick as you'd like. It's okay if you have these like emotional relapses.
Yeah.
But I think that this episode is going to help you understand what it is to move forward. Like, mm-hmm. What are the steps?
What do you have to do to move forward and get through it, but move through it?
Yeah, there's a difference.
We'll talk about that. Yeah.
Man, I heard this quote recently that I just loved. It was very similar to what you just said.
Mm-hmm.
We move through things. We don't just get through things. Like, getting through implies that you're just letting things happen and hoping things change.
Right. Which, grief is about moving through it, not getting through it.
Yeah. The only way out is through.
Yes.
That was the quote I heard. It's like, the only way out is through.
Yes.
You have to move through it.
And our program literally does that.
Yeah. This is crazy. So in doing a lot of this research, what we did when we designed our course was we just documented the process that we took to get to where we are today.
Mm-hmm.
And not just in our romantic relationship, but in the other relationships that we've dealt with just like this.
Yeah.
Whether it's someone I've worked with close in recovery, whether it's someone that we know and love intimately, part of our family, friend circle, we took everything that we had learned and we pumped out this course.
Yeah.
And without realizing, I think that if I could go back in time, knowing what I know now after doing a lot of this research, I think that our course is more than anything, it's a healthy way to grieve. Mm-hmm. It's a healthy way to move forward and empower yourself and build resiliency.
Exactly.
If it is anything at all.
Right. Because that's what you do. You build resilience.
Yeah.
In order to cope.
So let's go through there's an article from Psychology Today.
Yeah.
They're always fun reads, but this one, like, I think better than most.
Yeah. This is from Suzanne Degas White, doctor. I don't know how to say that.
I would say Degs.
Degs.
Suzanne Degs, Dr. Suzanne Degs White.
Yeah. So there's eight different points that you go through.
To build resilience.
To build resilience, to kind of go through it. And our course does this, but we're going to break it down.
So real quick, it's important to note that when we talk about what are we going to do, like what are we trying to accomplish as we're talking about all this, like how do we get from A to B? How do we move through it? Mm-hmm. How do we go through this? It's about building resiliency. And so for just a moment, you read The Comfort Crisis.
I read part of it.
Okay.
So I haven't finished it, but I love it. Like the whole idea of it.
I would venture to say that we are less resilient now as a species than we've ever been.
Absolutely.
Because everything is so comfortable. Everything is designed to make us comfortable.
Right. And everyone, like even on social media and everything that we read, it's like, oh, as long as you're happy, as long as you're comfortable, as long as, you know, things are feel good in the moment, then everything is great. But in reality, we need adversity in our life to build resilience, to get through all of the tough crap that we're going through right now.
Yeah. I mean, that's where you get the experience on how to deal with life, you know, like, mm-hmm. like with our children, like we've always made it a point to forcibly put them through resilient situations in which they have to develop resilience.
Yes. And it's not like emotional, you know, adversity, things like that. It's basically going out in the cold without a jacket, going out in the rain without an umbrella. Those little things can teach children so much about life and how to build resilience.
Big time.
Yeah. Tell the story about MJ.
This past weekend?
Yeah.
With the rain and everything?
Yeah.
So we were in Arizona watching baseball. They play baseball in Arizona before the season starts because the weather's perfect. Every day it's like 75 degrees and it's sunny. And I've been going there for a while. I've never encountered rain before. And
not it's usually just, gorgeous
not,
there.
Not just rain, freaking hail. So we went to a game.
What size is the hail?
Like pea size.
Little pea sizes?
Man, okay. So we were out at this game. It started to rain a little bit. And so we tried to seek cover. But the stadiums aren't designed with like solid roofs or covers because it's always sunny. So they're all like perforated metal. And so it just rains through there. Mm-hmm. So we were just getting nailed with rain. And when I say rain, it was like torrential downpour, like sideways rain, big old fat rain, like Forrest Gump would say. Just nasty, nasty rain. And he was sitting there and he had about 2 seconds of patience for it and just started complaining. And I stopped him and I was like, hey, listen, you need to learn how to deal with some of this kind of stuff. Like, this is life. You're going to get wet sometimes. You're going to be a little cold sometimes. Resilience. I'm trying to teach you resilience. We're going to sit here and we're going to wait it out as long as we can. And if it gets too bad, we'll go home. But we're not leaving at the first sign of discomfort. Mm-hmm. That's not how life works.
Yeah.
That's not how relationships work. That's not how recovery works. That is not something you need to get used to doing. You need to get used to dealing with some adversity and being resilient. So we were sitting there and then it started to get worse and worse and worse and worse. So it got to the point where in the intercom, they announced that the game was canceled. So I'm like, okay, so now we have to leave. So we're walking out and then all of a sudden I get smacked in the face with something. It felt like a bee stung me. And I look down and it's just hailing at this point, pea-sized hail. So we're just getting pelted. And he's just like, ow, ow, like trying to take cover, you know? We're just laughing about it at this point.
Yeah.
It wasn't dangerous. It was just a hurt. It was a nuisance.
One of those things.
And we got done and we got back to the hotel and like he was shivering and I was cold and he was letting me know every 2 seconds he was cold. I was like, do you think that I'm not cold? We were in the same rain. Like, I'm cold too. It's mm-hmm. okay. We're going to be okay. Everything's going to be okay. He learned something though. He learned something through that. Little examples like that. We try to show them. Like we send them to summer camp every year for 2 weeks with no phones. They don't know anybody, or they know they're not kids that they grew up with, or like they know here.
Yeah,
they see them at camp.
Some people
and that's
they talk
it.
To every day.
But the reason we did that was not because we wanted to get rid of our kids for 2 weeks. We wanted to develop resilience. We wanted them to have to fend for themselves, mm-hmm. get homesick, deal with missing mom and dad.
And it's really, really hot there too.
Yeah.
And they let them play outside and they get red face and they sweat and they stink.
They come home with scabs
and they love
black
it.
Eyes
and sprained ankles.
Yeah.
Like, it's good for them. Mm-hmm. It's really good. And I think of, like, we go to the grocery store with the kids, or when I go to the grocery store with the kids and it's pouring down rain, I don't wait for the rain to go away. Like, we get out and I'm like, let's go have fun. Like, I feel energized after going out in the rain and feeling cold or whatever. It's like, I make it fun.
Feel alive.
Yes, you do. You feel alive.
And I think the moments when I've been at my lowest and I was able to work through them, I feel so empowered by that, mm-hmm. that I was able to get through it on my own.
Yeah.
Like, it's like when you accomplish a goal you never thought you could. It's like, I did that.
That's what builds up your self-esteem and your confidence.
So that's what we're trying to accomplish here. Hey, don't get me wrong. It's not to say that you're not resilient. If you're in a relationship with an alcoholic or an addict,
yeah.
you're pretty effing resilient.
Right.
But
you just need the guidance to push forward.
We know you have a high pain tolerance, obviously, mm-hmm. because you're able to deal with all this crap.
Yeah.
But what you're asked to do when you're confronting this type of grief and moving forward in it is to go against every instinct that you have to stay. Every instinct that you have that's telling you, stay, another chance, it's going to get better, hope. It doesn't always get better.
Right.
And like, I have evidence in my life to show that it can and it also can't. I've seen it go both ways.
Mm-hmm.
Both ways.
Yep.
Doesn't always work this way, but you'll know in your heart when you've had enough.
Yeah.
You'll know in your heart when you've had enough.
Yeah.
And if you feel like you've had enough, this is how you move forward. So let's get into it.
All right. Well, the first thing you're going to do is name the loss for what it is. You know, no calling it something like, oh, it's just heavy drinking. Is it addiction, substance abuse, alcoholism, or even an abusive person? Like, you just name it, put the real name to it, label to it, because it kind of helps you have that feeling of, ooh, this is what it is. It's part of the acceptance piece. The second one.
Was it a Freudian slip?
That's what I was going to ask. All right. The second one is to allow yourself to feel pain. And we talk about this all the time. We actually have a sticker that says feel the feels. Pretending that everything is fine when it's not prevents you from moving forward and healing. And there's a lot has a lot to do with like toxic positivity, you know, just look at the bright side. Everything's okay. But is it? You wouldn't be here listening to this stuff if it wasn't okay.
Yeah, it's not okay. And back to name the loss for what it is.
Yeah.
Man, this is, you know, I always have the dumbest metaphors, but have you ever seen,
they're not dumb.
Have you ever seen exorcism movies? I always liked those movies. They always freaked me out the most. Exorcists?
Yeah.
When an exorcist, like when someone's possessed by a demon, they're able to get the demon out by calling it by its name. That's what they do. They call it by its name. Once they name it, it's like, ooh, you exist. You're the problem. And we can all acknowledge the elephant in the room.
Yes.
So it is important. Like, I know that a lot of people don't like labels, and I get it. Like, I know people in addiction that don't like, they don't even refer to themselves as an alcoholic.
There are sometimes I don't like labels. I'll be honest.
I get it. But I think for the purposes of this exercise, it's really important.
I agree.
We need to call it what it is.
I agree.
Quit beating around the bush. Don't sugarcoat it. Mm-hmm. Let's just call it what it is.
Yep. Yep. Do you have anything to add to allow yourself to feel the pain?
It's crucial. I think it's a necessary part of the healing process to feel pain. Once again, I think I mentioned like we're at an all-time low when it comes to resiliency just as a species, because technology, the world, commerce has been rewarded for making things more comfortable. Think about like Uber Eats or like DoorDash, like some of the biggest companies.
My guilty pleasure.
Some of the biggest companies, they don't really sell anything but convenience.
Yeah.
They're selling a service that makes life easier. In some way, if it makes life easier, people are going to flock to it.
Yeah.
Like, our kids cannot deal with commercials. That's another thing.
Yeah.
We had standard cable in our hotel, and he was so irritated. And I was like, you have no idea what it was like growing up in the 80s and 90s, whenever, if you missed your show, you missed your show, and you had to watch commercials, and that's just part of it. But everything's become just so easy for us.
Yeah.
Whatever he wants, the tip of our fingers, phones, smartphones made information just instant.
Yep.
Instant gratification is the name of the game. So like, I lean into the pain. Mm-hmm. I feel the pain on purpose. I know I need to feel it. There's a psychological benefit to feeling pain. And this is true. One of the reasons I became an addict, like in my home growing up, if you had a problem, here's a pill.
Yeah.
And so I wonder, like, where did that come from? Like, oh, you have a headache? Here's a pill. If you have a cough, here, take this syrup, whatever it might be.
If you feel sad, here.
Yeah. That's how we think life works. Mm-hmm. Like, we're supposed to feel uncomfortable emotions. We're supposed to feel some degree of pain.
Yeah.
It's part of the healing process. It's a very Western thing that we think that we're not supposed to be in pain.
Right.
Look, if you know anything about the opioid crisis and how that happened and how they were able to really push that narrative, like Purdue was able to push that narrative on the doctors, it was because they were trying to eliminate pain. And they had this, like this virtue signaling, performative empathy, performative compassion way of describing how people are in pain and they shouldn't be. BS.
Yeah.
People are supposed to be in some degree of pain.
Absolutely. And it helps you make decisions. It helps you listen to your instincts better and to know what to do next.
Yeah. When you touch a hot stove, it burns you. You typically don't do it again.
Don't do it again.
Typically don't.
Right. It's an accident.
We learn through pain signals in our bodies and in our minds.
Mm-hmm.
We have to feel pain. So if you're trying to avoid the pain, you're not doing yourself any favors.
Well, it's kind of like with the kids when they were babies. I didn't baby-proof the house very much.
Nah, man. You got a knot on your head?
I didn't. I mean, there were some things, but I look at things these days and I'm like, wow, there's so much out there to baby-proof stuff. When I needed my kids to recognize if they fall or hit them their head a little bit, then they're not going to do it again.
Yeah. And there's a gray area here. Like,
absolutely.
Don't get me wrong.
Like, I'll protect them.
Like, we didn't leave needles laying around.
Okay. Right. And the stairs, I did have a
baby gate.
Even though they did fall down the stairs,
the baby gate
didn't even matter. They both did.
He snuck up there.
But it that's just life, man. All right. So the next one is acknowledge that you have the power to change your own actions, but be okay with not being able to change others, mm-hmm. which is what we talk about all the time. Like, you cannot change the addict in your life, but you do have power to change what you want.
Yeah. Like we mentioned, we're trying to build resilience, but to expound upon that, the goal is to live well despite not knowing.
Mm-hmm.
And to be able to accomplish that, I think a lot of people love answers. Like, we love to know that 2 + 2 = 4 every time.
Yeah.
Things aren't so simple in the world. They're not. No. And we just have a lack of resilience and understanding that that's not always the case. And life ain't fair. It's not.
Yep. All right. You mentioned this earlier, but this one is on here too. Don't sugarcoat the situation.
No, it's so easy. And I'm the most guilty person about this ever. In sugarcoating things and looking at the positives and like this, we've talked about it a lot, toxic positivity. Like when someone's going through something, just focus on gratitude. Like, what do you have to be grateful for today? There's a time and a place for that. This is not one of them. It's not. And so when are we going to talk about both and thinking?
Later.
Okay. So I don't need to bring it up here.
I mean, I guess you can. We just won't talk about it later.
I mean, F. Scott Fitzgerald, I believe, said that the hallmark of intelligence is to be able to hold two opposing thoughts at the same time and retain the ability to function.
You're talking like me today.
I'm all over the place. But holding two thoughts at the same time.
Uh-huh.
Very, very difficult to do. So go back up real quick. Yeah. So when we talk about sugarcoating the situation, don't dismiss the bad.
Mm-hmm.
Don't just look at the good. Don't just try to find gratitude. If it's a bad situation, you live with an abusive asshole, just say it. It is what it is.
Yeah.
This is the reality of your life right now.
Right.
This is what it is. Like, right. If you try to sugarcoat it, you will stay in this longer.
Yeah. And if you listen to us, you know that we don't sugarcoat shit. So that's kind
of... No, we did an episode on overthinking.
Overthinking. And then the...
Overreacting.
Right.
As well. Listen mm-hmm. to those and... give you some insight as to whether or not you're overthinking or overreacting.
Well, also the denial one that we did recently too.
That too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Those are helpful.
The next one is going to be separate yourself from the person who is lost. So grief is about moving through it, not getting through it, which is what we talked about earlier. If you allow yourself to become enmeshed with the other person, you keep yourself from moving through and end up stuck inside the problem.
Yes. Yeah. This is... again, like, this has never been our goal to sit here and just tell people to leave.
No, but we have experience here.
Yeah. I will tell you something. I used to be really, really, really involved with the person in my life that I mentioned earlier that's caused me all kinds of consternation and problems, and that I held out hope that they would figure it out. And if I just explained things more clearly, and if I just was more compassionate, and if I just watched my side of the street cleaner, that everything would be okay. Things have never been easier than when I just separated myself. All that just came to an end. And don't get me wrong, it hurts, man. Mm-hmm. There are times where I break down and it hurts. It yeah. still hurts. And it's been a while and it still hurts.
Yeah.
Because they're not dead. They're still alive. And to yes. some degree, if they're still alive, that means that the opportunity exists that you'll see them or interact with them in some way. Mm-hmm. And it's painful.
Yeah.
It's really painful, especially when they love bomb you.
Mm.
Really, really painful when that happens. Because you feel like an a-hole. You feel like you're 2 inches tall.
Yep.
And it's easy to forget why you did it, like why you separated yourself. But then I have to just look at my life since. It's like, man, I'm just happier. I don't have any drama in my life anymore. That disappeared. I don't argue and fight with anyone. So I wasn't the problem here. I know I wasn't. Mm-hmm. Life got so much easier.
Right.
And I have tons of friends. I have tons of people I talk to every day. So it's not like I'm alone on an island and I'm the asshole. It's like that old saying, if you on the way to work, if you run into an asshole, it's good chances are you just ran into an asshole. Like people mm-hmm. this guy was just having a bad day. He's going through a lot, whatever it might be. But if you find yourself running into assholes all day long, you're the asshole. It's not the case. Mm-hmm. Separated myself and I was able to move through it once I did.
Yeah.
And it's no different than alcohol, right? Like in AA, we teach people the first thing you have to do is separate yourself from the substance.
Yes.
All that does is set the stage for the healing that takes place through the work. It's the same thing here. The same principle applies. If you're still in this, if you're still showing up in this, it's not going to get better if they're still doing what they're doing.
Yeah, but even if they're not using and the behaviors are still present because they're not working on themselves, that counts too.
Yeah, if they just remove the substance, like the chances that gets better quickly are zero.
Yeah.
It's going to take like, there are people who just stop drinking and they have no problems, right? That happens. Like, I don't know what fraction or percentage that is of people, but I would say like close to zero. It's a very, it's very, very small, very number small of people. Number.
Yeah.
The ones that you see that are happy and the ones that you hear like us and like my story about recovery, it's a lot of hard effing work. It's like mm-hmm. cracking the books, listening to the podcast, going to therapy, going to 12 step meetings,
yeah,
working with other people, volunteering. Like you're really, really working on it.
Yeah.
Like things can get better. But if someone just puts the bottle down, congrats, I guess, but you haven't really fixed anything yet. No. You can, if you choose to do something different, but if you're just removing the substance, all you've done is just take away the anesthetic. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Yeah.
Now you're just going to feel everything and everyone around you will too.
Yeah. So true.
So yeah, it's, man, it's tough. It's tough to separate yourself from it. But when you do, and you go in the community and ask people who have stepped away and how they feel.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're going to have an episode coming up here soon, with a guest that's going to talk about this too.
Yes. Yes, we are. But also if you're not able to separate yourself physically, obviously a lot of people aren't ready there. That's where you start practicing detaching.
Yeah. Like
within your relationship.
I think in the context of ambiguous loss, when it comes to an alcoholic or an addict, you can do this, but people who are caretakers of dementia or Alzheimer's patients don't really have this option. Maybe yeah. you can spread the workload out with other people. Maybe you can, if you're able to, you can hire a caretaker, but this is different. Like you are voluntarily showing up in this.
Right. All right. The next one is don't make excuses or take on blame for choices another person is making. When faced with a tragedy, many people jump into superhero mode, imagining they have superpowers that can right the wrongs of others. This is a total normal fantasy, but not a reality. Don't beat yourself up for being human.
Talk to me a bit about the responsibility you feel as a mother to fix problems and the power that you feel that you have to correct issues.
Like with our kids? I mean, there's a gray area there.
Let me ask a different way. So I feel like as a mother, you successfully put out 1,000 fires a day.
Okay. Yeah.
You solve problems for them all day long.
Right. Right. But that's my job a little bit. I still let them fix their own problems. But as a mom, I have to guide them to fix their problems.
Professionals have the same thing. Like if you're a manager or a boss of some kind.
Or a teacher.
Yeah. Like your job is like people bring you problems all day. That's what they do. And your job is to solve problems.
Right.
I think what you're getting at here is that that logic does not apply.
No.
Doesn't apply here. Mm-mm. It's really hard to not fall into that superhero mode though. Where it's like, oh, there's a problem. Okay. I see the fix here. I'll just make him quit drinking. I'll make him go to meetings.
Doesn't work that way.
We'll have big conversations about it. I'll watch him. I'll breathalyze him. I'll do all this stuff. Just doesn't apply.
No.
And you have to drop that fantasy.
Right.
Don't beat yourself up for it, but you have to get rid of it.
Mm-hmm. All right. The next one is acknowledge the person's absence. So allow yourself to grieve what you are missing, but accept that life must go on. If you choose to stay stuck in the what might have been, you are only adding to the suffering that the loss itself created. It's kind of what we talked about earlier about just getting through it and focusing on just like what could be. You're going to hinder your grieving process.
Sometimes they're easier than others too. Like I think about for me, like with this person in my life that I've mentioned, like the holidays are really tough.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough, man. Like, you know, every holiday movie that exists about happy family units. I don't have one, you know, friends, family. It's just, and you're reminded of it. So you have to acknowledge that person's absence and allow yourself to grieve what you're missing. Be honest about it, but also accepting that life can go on.
Yep.
That life will go on, that right. you can reframe hope. And we'll get to that later.
Yeah. All right. And then community. So chatting with others who get it is healing and validating. So just talking with others is going to be a big part of your grieving process.
Pain shared is pain lessened. I believe in that wholeheartedly. That pain shared is pain lessened. That whenever you're writing something, even if it's to nobody, if you're sharing something in a community like TUFO community and Al-Anon meeting, church, wherever you're able to do this kind of stuff and get around a community of people with similar interest, it's very validating and it's healing. if you're going to try to do this on your own, it's going to be really, really, really tough. Someone I admire in recovery is Celeste Yvonne. She wrote the book, It's Not About the Wine.
Yeah.
And she recovered very much on her own in the beginning. And she talks about that journey. She's an incredibly resilient person, extremely smart. And if you haven't checked that book out, check it out. It's Not About the Wine. It's amazing. I think it's on sale right now, actually. But she said that she could go back and do one thing. It would be that she would have found a community, whether it be through AA or another group of people, like another group of moms that were trying to get sober. It would have been a hell of a lot easier.
Same. I never had a group. My group didn't come about until TUFO. That was a year ago.
Yeah. And you see, so you after did this I on was, your own forever. When
I mean, I went to therapy, but I didn't have a support group. It was still difficult because people around me were still invalidating me. Those who were close to me still didn't understand, you know? I didn't have a group. I didn't know. I was alone for a really long time. If I were to have had a group earlier to know that they went through something very similar, I think it would have been better for me.
So what's it been like before and after the community?
I'm still processing a little bit of that, to be honest with you, because sometimes I still read things and I'm like, oh my gosh, like I wasn't crazy, you know, like I'm being validated still by what I went through when I spent years feeling so crazy. So being in the community has been big for me. Really, really big for me.
It's huge. There's a reason it exists and we encourage people to use it.
Yeah.
And we encourage people to get involved, get involved. Like I actually left a comment in there today. Someone was mentioning something about someone who's trying to get sober on their own. They didn't want to go to any sort of community. I talked about the importance of community. There's this woman that I know in recovery who's been sober since 95. She's amazing. She lives here locally. I think you know her.
Yeah.
You've met her. She's so sweet. But she says that recovery and communities, it's sort of like in the African Sahara. There's zebras hanging out and they hang out in packs. On the outside of the pack, you get like the stragglers. Those are the ones that the lions go after because they're easy to pick off. They're out there by themselves, kind of doing their own thing, trying to figure things out on their own. The ones in the middle of the pack are protected. They're insulated. They're insulated from the strength of the group, from the community. I think of communities like AA or Celebrate Recovery or Smart Recovery or Life Ring or whatever you choose to do, whatever it might be, whether it's a spiritual or secular way of recovery, having those people, it's huge. It's huge. You're insulated. If you're getting your ass there and you're making the coffee for everyone, that dude stays sober. Like we say that the guy that makes the coffee at the 6:30 a.m. meeting, he's sober. You can guarantee that dude's sober. Mm-hmm. The guy that kind of shows up late, leaves early, no one knows.
Yeah.
Dude just stops coming, stops showing up. Get involved. Get involved. This is your life. This is your reality. It may not be what you wanted, but it is.
Mm-hmm.
It is what it is.
Yeah.
So you might as well enjoy it.
Yeah. Talking about it just has been super helpful for me.
Yeah.
And pushed my healing even further.
Yeah.
All right. So what hinders the process?
So Dr. Pauline Boss, she is like,
she is a boss.
She is. She is the godmother, I will say, of ambiguous loss. She introduced this concept. This is her work. She wrote an article with, oh my goodness, this person's name. Oh, I'm sorry. I should have known this. Janet Yeats. I'm going to say Yeats.
Yeats.
It's either Yeats or Yeats. But there's an article, and we'll link this. It's called Ambiguous Loss, a Complicated Type of Grief When Loved Ones Disappear. They talk about building resilience, and they have a process for doing this. And what's really cool is that as I was going through all this, our course does every single one of these things.
Yeah.
Every single one of these things.
It was a light bulb moment.
It was like, oh my God. Yeah. We nailed it, didn't we?
Yes, yes. We know so what cool. we're doing.
But again, I mentioned that the goal is to live well despite not knowing. The first thing that they encourage people to do is to find meaning. Finding meaning. So Viktor Frankl, I've mentioned Frankl before.
Yeah.
Wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning. It's about him trying to find meaning in his time in a concentration camp. He said that without meaning, there is no hope. And without hope, there is no meaning. So how do people make sense out of ambiguous loss? It takes time, but you begin by naming the problem. You mentioned that.
Yep.
And then reframing what hope looks like.
Yeah.
I wrote a blog article. Is it a blog article? Just a blog. I wrote a blog. It's on our website, tufo.com. You can check it out. It's called Hope is Beautiful, Hope is Dangerous. Because we get hopeful. I'm like, I've said it before. I'm on the record saying like, I hate us in some ways. I do. I hate us because I think we give people the wrong impression of what's typical. because this isn't typical.
Right.
It's not. But hope can be a beautiful thing for people, because some people will get exactly what we got. They'll get exactly what we got. And we can inspire them to do that. I can inspire people in recovery. That's the reason I go and I speak at places. You could do exactly what I did. Just if you want what I have, do what I did.
Yeah.
It's that simple. I'll show you how to do it. I'll meet with you, get coffee. We'll figure it out together. But I hate us in some ways, because generally people find us whenever their loved one turned in like an all-time classic, like when they were supposed to be at work and then you get a call from jail at 9 p.m. or, you know, they were supposed to be sober and then you find them just passed out on the floor at 2 p.m. when you come home from work. Like, so you hop on your favorite app and you search something like alcoholic husband or alcoholic spouse or spouse of an alcoholic. And then we pop up.
Yeah.
And you see us, you're like, oh my God, like they figured it out. And then boom, hope. It hits you. It's intoxicating. It's just like, oh my God, look at this. People get hopeful about that. And I think they stay in it too long when they have evidence to the contrary. Reframe hope. That's what the article is about. It's about reframing hope. Mm-hmm. What else could you be hopeful about? Reframe hope.
Yeah.
So not just hope that your relationship will work out, but that you can be happy in spite of this person doing what they're always going to do.
Exactly.
Not like changing.
My whole thing has been that I'm okay with or without you. I had to build up that resilience to be okay with or without you. And that's a very healthy place to be.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, like in my life, this person that I've dealt with, I had to reframe hope. And this is someone that's very close to me, my family. And it's the role in a family that if you were to lose them, it's like, oh my gosh, like everything I thought was true is a lie. And I don't know what life looks like. And I was lost from it all. For a while there, I was like, I don't even know how you recover from this. I don't, but I've reframed it. I think that something that I've done in my own recovery as well is I can look at my life and see where I went wrong and say, that doesn't have to be the case for my kids. I can ensure that they have a better example of a healthy family member than I did.
Yeah.
I can ensure that. I can do everything in my power to make sure that happens. And I become hopeful about that.
Exactly.
I become hopeful about the way that holidays look in a different way now.
Exactly.
I become hopeful about the people I can reach through my message and in recovery and through what we do here at TUFO. Mm-hmm. I reframed it. It's so much of recovery is alchemy. Like alchemy is like from the medieval times and ancient times. It's taking worthless materials like lead and turning them into gold.
Yeah.
It's making something amazing out of trash.
Yeah.
That's what you have to do.
Right.
You take your experience, what you've been through, and say, well, how can I produce meaning from this?
Right.
How can I get hopeful from this?
Yeah. And I mean, that's what we did. Like, I'm not grateful for what we went through, but I am grateful for what we did with it. Because like my IG quote is, experience is not what happens to you. It is what you do with what happens to you. That was another thing that kind of like pulled this all together, because we were reading something and I was like, Matt, that's my quote on IG that has been there for like 2 years now.
Fitting, right?
Yes, because it's not like some people will say this will make you stronger. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And in a way, yes, but it's what you do with it that makes you stronger. And that's what we did. We were able to reframe everything and turn our crap into gold.
I hear people at meetings share a lot that they're grateful alcoholics. And I think someone who's new is like, what the hell did he just say?
Mm-hmm.
You're grateful for this? Mm-hmm. But that's why.
Yeah.
You have the opportunity to become uniquely useful and purposeful in the world.
Yes.
Very, very unique opportunity that a lot of people don't get. Most normal people are walking around wondering what their purpose is.
Yeah.
Yours is very, very evident. Whether or not you want to accept it is up to you. You could be a beacon of hope for others.
Yeah.
Getting through this.
Yep.
Reframing it. But what hinders, back to your question, what hinders it is isolation.
Okay.
Anger, desire for revenge, and family secrets. That makes finding meaning in this much, much more difficult. Especially the isolation piece.
Family secrets hinders it.
Yeah.
It's whenever you don't speak your truth.
Yeah.
It's almost like where you say everything is okay.
Or you don't come outside of the family unit. So let's say that I'm an alcoholic and you're ashamed by it and no one knows. This is a very common thing.
Oh yeah.
What happens in our family stays in our family. We're not talking about this.
I know. I've been conditioned on certain levels to do this. Not within my family, but otherwise.
What you're doing is you're not allowing not just yourself, but the other people around you in your family to make meaning of what their experience has been. You are shorting them the opportunity to take this, what they've been through, the experience, and make something of it.
Yeah.
You're not allowing them the first step in recovery, which is to say, this is what's happened. While it's not what I've wished for, here's what I'm going to do with it. Family secrets can absolutely hinder that.
Yeah.
The next thing is tempering mastery. So questions like, how do I let go of what I cannot control? Control freaks, right? Like, mm-hmm. I think that a lot of people could identify as control freaks.
Yeah.
I think that, I don't know, I don't want to get into codependency again, but like, I think that a big theme there is that these people are just control freaks. In some ways it's true, in some ways it's not.
Well, yeah. I mean, we've been down that road and why people do what they do.
I don't know.
When
like when someone's
freaks.
Drowning and they're thrashing for air, are they a control freak because they want to breathe again?
Right.
I disagree.
Like, no.
Some things I could see, absolutely.
Yeah.
Some things for sure. But tempering mastery, so that this is understanding the world is not always fair. It can help individuals decrease guilt and blame, self blame. When it's difficult, if not impossible, to master or control the ambiguity, the uncertainty surrounding a loss, we encourage individuals and families to balance the feelings of helplessness with internal self-mastery. So that's through meditation, prayer, mindfulness, playing music, exercising.
Self-care. This is what we preach.
This is the reason we ask y'all every day to post what you're doing for yourselves.
Yep.
This is the reason we do this. What can you control? What can you control? If you can't control, if you can't master your outside environment, you can master the one within.
Yes.
How do we do that? This is why we're so big on this. Like, I'm telling y'all, like, there's a method to our madness.
Yes.
There's a method to our madness. We're not just saying random stuff because we think it'd be a good idea.
No. This is
there's
like
a reason
on
for it.
Point.
But what hinders this is believing that bad things only happen to bad people, believing that there's like justice in the world.
Like karma,
yeah.
too?
Yeah. Basically.
I mean, some of that as well is karma.
Yeah. Like, believing that the harder one works, the less one will suffer. And finally, believing that we should always be able to control things.
Yeah. I mean, there are no guarantees in life.
Zero. Death and like, taxes. That's
yeah.
It.
Yeah. But there's no like how we say like life's not fair and we want certain outcomes to happen. It just doesn't typically work that way. We have to be okay with accepting life on life's terms.
Yes. That was the theme of my life for the first 5-6 years I was sober.
Yeah.
Like, let me just learn how to do that today.
Yeah.
I had a really hard time with it.
Yeah, you did. But
really
you grew through that though. And you figured out what it really meant.
Yeah. It's hard to phase me now. Mm-hmm. It's tough. Mm-hmm. Like, cause I understand that stuff just happens. Like, it just kind of rolls off of me.
Yeah.
Some things I have agency over, most things I don't.
Yeah.
It's how I react to them. I'm responsible for my effort, not the outcomes. I'm responsible for my reactions and responses.
Boom.
And that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
Okay. The next step in this is reconstructing your identity. So uh-huh. redefining relationships is helpful in developing resilience after ambiguous loss. So, excuse me, I drank so much water. I got trying to come back up.
It's not sparkling water, is it?
No, but you might be asking questions like, well, who am I now that I've lost or that I'm dealing with this ambiguous loss of my loved one? Like, who am I now that my husband is unrecognizable? Am I still technically a wife, even though we're like separated?
Right. We've talked about how this life makes you lose your identity.
You will lose your identity.
Yeah. And so you have to rebuild your identity.
Reconstruct it. So there's a tendency to hold on to status quo in hopes that things will go back to normal. Like we think that if we can just hang on, everything's going to go back to normal.
If we switch, if we change the way we react, if we do something different, if we do whatever differently, then things will be better. But it's not up to you.
No, and addiction is a progressive disease.
Right.
It gets worse over time, not better. So it is unlikely that things are going to go back to normal. So then it's up to you to change identity. Mm-hmm. That's what it comes down to. What hinders growth here is resisting change, waiting for closure, and staying isolated from others. Once again, isolation is really bad for developing resilience.
But I also believe that being isolated from those who might hinder your progress is important. I don't think isolating from people that get it.
No, we're talking about the community.
Right.
We're talking about community. Once again, community in the sense that these people understand what you're going through.
I just wanted to be clear
relate,
on that.
Valid. Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah.
Because I do know that there are times where you do have isolating periods that help you heal. And it's from those like closest to you.
Yeah.
I mean, it just kind of part, it's part of the process. But when it comes to a community, stick with them.
What we're trying to do, like through our work here at TUFO, is wake people up. And once you're awake, you don't go back to sleep.
You can't unlearn what you learn.
No, it's like saying, like knowing now what I know about recovery, if I decided to drink or use drugs again, it would be the worst experience of all time.
Yeah.
Like, cause I know the truth now. So it would be horrible.
Yeah.
It'd be horrible.
Right.
So reconstructing your identity is crucial to moving forward, to developing resilience. The next thing is normalizing ambivalence. So having thoughts like, I'm happy I'm married, but I hate this life. Or when it comes to like someone with dementia, like loved ones will often have the feeling, and I've known people who've had these feelings and shared them with me, like I'm grateful my mom's here, but man, like it would be easier if she just passed.
Right. Like, yeah.
And
yeah.
Not feeling guilty for thinking that either.
I think that's a very normal, common feeling that has been stigmatized, and we need to normalize that a little bit more.
Yeah. So with ambiguous loss, we have to normalize these conflicting emotions
mm-hmm.
because the ambiguity seeds them. It actually makes it worse. Like the ambiguity is what causes them. And then if you don't normalize them, it's just like a self-perpetuating circle. It just keeps going.
Exactly.
It just keeps going and going and going and going.
Mm-hmm.
You have to acknowledge and just normalize. You're going to have these thoughts.
Right.
And it's okay.
And it's okay.
Like once again,
that's just like feel the feels. Like it's okay to feel that way. However you feel is okay.
Yeah. Well, what was the other but and that you had written down?
Did we not talk about it? Oh, I have both the anxiety of no closure and the opportunity to move forward with my life in a new way.
Yeah.
That's okay.
It's okay.
You can feel that both. You can feel both.
Yeah.
I can have compassion for someone and not tolerate the behavior and not have them a part of my life.
Yes.
You can still have compassion for them.
You can do both. Polarized thinking or black and white thinking, all or nothing thinking, is the most common cognitive distortion I would say that people have. It's very Western to think that things are either black or white, left or right, up or down. It's not true. Emotions definitely don't work that way.
Right. And once you start practicing these thoughts and you start practicing, it's going to feel weird. It's going to feel weird because you've been conditioned to think one way or the other. And it goes against a lot of the way that we're raised or in schools or, you know, certain religions. It's like, no, it's either this or that, good or bad, you know. But when you start practicing and changing it, it's kind of a relief because then there is no
control. No rules. There's no rules, yeah, man.
Exactly.
There's no rules.
It's amazing when you get to that point when you're like, oh, it's a relief and you can see things more clearly. That was my experience with it.
If you would define yourself as a rigid person, mm-hmm. let's soften those edges.
Yeah.
Let's soften those edges. What hinders growth here, what doesn't help, is denying those feelings and also rage at yourself and other people when you have these.
Yeah.
Or other people having them as well. Like, it's okay. You can have two thoughts at the same time, two opposing thoughts at the mm-hmm. same time. It's mm-hmm. actually a healthy thing.
Yeah.
It's a healthy thing.
It is.
The next step here is five, revising attachment. So how do I both let go and still remember? Ambiguous loss assumes attachment. The pain of loss comes from the loss of that close relationship. The ability to hold and practice both and thinking, so two things
about
at the same time,
yeah.
helps people discover new insights and transformations of attachment to their lost loved one. They learned with both and thinking that there's no closure and that they can both hold on to what was and seek new relationships. What hinders the revision of attachment is thinking one needs to get over it. And there needs to be an end to the attachment to the missing person. There doesn't have to be an end.
No.
Something this is hilarious. This is a personal anecdote here. Paige has always hated movies that didn't have a clear cut ending.
Uh-huh.
Like when
our daughter is the same way.
Yeah. When the director leaves it ambiguous and leaves it sort of up to like your own creativity or like.
It used to piss me off. We would leave movie theaters and I would say, I didn't like it. I didn't, that ending was stupid. I was so mad. And now I've actually come to appreciate it because then I realized that I don't have to know the outcome. I can have an imagination. Like it's actually really cool.
It's really cool not to know.
It's cool not to know.
Like the beauty's in the mystery of it all in some ways.
Yes. And it taught me to like, let go of an outcome because that's really how life is. You don't know the outcome.
Yep.
Thanks.
So revising attachment means grieving what and who is lost while celebrating what remains.
Mm.
You can do both.
Yeah.
You can do both. The last one is discovering hope.
Yeah.
So how do I find hope in an ongoing loss that has no closure? It sounds like an impossible task if you're new to this, if you're in the middle of this and it's like, this is fresh, you're just learning about this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But once people become more comfortable with the ambiguity and uncertainty, they're freer to imagine and discover new sources of hope. Please go read the blog I wrote on this.
Yes. So good.
We encourage them to laugh at the absurdity and ambiguous loss while also acknowledging the pain of it. We help them redefine justice, perhaps by putting their energies into helping others to avoid the pain they have suffered. We brainstorm with them to imagine new options for creating hope for themselves, even for caregivers who are housebound. We encourage them imagining what they might do in the future. What hinders here is insisting on an end to grief and suffering. This impedes the opportunity to build resilience. We're after resilience, but you can reframe hope. You can rediscover hope.
Mm-hmm.
Frankl, for instance, said there are three ways to find meaning. He said, what are they? It was through acts, like service to other people.
Yeah.
It was, what were they? Hang on. I got these written down somewhere. I should know.
Did
this.
You I've write
read
it down?
This,
I know.
Read this book more times than I count.
I'm pretty sure you've quoted
Here
it
they
a
are.
Million times.
Deeds.
Okay.
Experience of values, whether it be creative, experiential, or attitudinal. So through some kind of medium. So like through art, nature, love in a relationship, experience of value, one of your values. And then suffering. He also says suffering. I found meaning through suffering. And I also find meaning through deeds. And now I find it through the experience of values.
Yeah.
But through suffering, I found meaning.
Yeah.
I suffered an addiction for many, many years. You suffered in a tumultuous relationship for many, many years.
Yep.
It was suffering. It was horrible. It was shit. It was not a way to live.
And then when I had my mental health issues, I suffered through that and I came out of it and, you know, help others get through theirs.
Become an alchemist.
Mm-hmm.
Think of the ways that you can turn all this trash into just gold, shining gold.
Yeah. If I were to say that this is my life, this is just how it is, I would have been stuck there.
Yeah.
I would have never gotten out of it. I had to reframe my outcome and my hope too. I had to say, you know what? I don't have to live like this. I can choose to take steps to get better and to work on myself.
There is a choice involved, isn't there?
Yes, there is.
And that's something we discussed earlier, is that sitting idle and just hoping for closure
mm-hmm.
will not result in closure.
No.
It just results in more suffering.
Yes.
That's all it does.
Yes.
You made a choice.
I did.
I made a choice.
Yes.
It involves a choice. Mm-hmm. It is a choice.
Mm-hmm.
And choices take little to no effort. It's just a choice. Just a choice. You make up your mind. You make a choice.
Yeah. But a lot of people are comfortable in the discomfort because they don't know. They're scared of the outcome. You know, they fear what could happen if they change.
Yeah.
Which is okay.
So I'm going to read just a few excerpts from another article. This was written by Madeline Sefter Abrams. This is from the American Journal of Psychotherapy. It's a really interesting article on ambiguous loss. It is called Resilience and Ambiguous Loss.
Okay.
So once again, resilience.
Yep.
So she says, in order to cope with ambiguous loss, individuals and families must first confront the change in their situation. I mentioned that earlier.
Yep.
They must be able to hold something meaningful of the past while letting go of that which is not in the present. And Boss suggests that mastery and spiritual acceptance of the situation are effective means of coping. Those affected by the ambiguous loss can learn that the situation may not change, but what they are hoping for can change.
That right there.
In order to resolve loss, people need to be able to make sense of it. However, as Boss says, in the case of ambiguous loss, gaining meaning is even more difficult than an ordinary loss because the grief itself remains unresolved. But if we cannot make sense out of ambiguity, nothing really changes. We merely endure.
Mm.
And who wants to endure, right? We want to live. We want to be happy again. We want to experience life. We want to be useful to other people. We want to have purpose.
Yes.
This is how we do it.
Yes.
So think about how you're going to develop resiliency.
Yep.
We'll link these articles in the show notes.
Yep.
But we've already presented people with a path to doing it through the course.
Through the course.
Mm-hmm. Also the community.
The community.
The podcast you listen to every week.
Everything. Yes.
The newsletters, all of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is a way to build resiliency. We're giving the community, we're giving you a voice, we're helping you reframe hope. find meaning in all this.
Yeah.
You know, carry two thoughts at the same time. We're really big on that. Like, this is what we're helping people do.
Yep.
So more than anything, I it's funny. Like, I was telling people, like, I think we're just unlicensed grief counselors.
I know. It's what you were saying yesterday. I was like, whoa, this is interesting.
Yeah. And if you would like more individualized help, we don't promote it a lot, but we do one-on-ones with people. So you can book time with us. If you ever have a question, like a specific question about your situation, you can book time with us.
Uh-huh. And we do email coaching as well.
And which email coaching is a great introduction into like what it is to have a mentor or a coach.
Yeah. And sometimes when you're able to type your thoughts out, it bumps your processing up a little bit more because you're putting it out there instead of having it in here.
Once again, like back to that, like creating meaning in it.
Yeah.
Not isolating.
Like right.
Putting it out there.
Yep.
Give it a name.
Yeah.
And like full disclosure, I think we've said this many times that we are not licensed counselors or anything else. We are people with lived experience. Mm-hmm. Now the course does have a medical component from someone who's more than qualified.
Right.
but our one-on-ones, it's just the lived experience of people who have been there before, worked through this on both sides, through addiction recovery, also through working through tough relationships. Both sides of it. So we get it and happy to walk you through it as well. If you do happen to purchase the course, something that is worth noting is that you do get office hours with us. So that doesn't mean just like, you know, like unfeathered access all the time, but shoot us an email, whatever you're working through, like you will get back a quality response about the best way to handle what it is you're dealing with.
Right. Yep. We help work you through it.
Yeah. We've been there before.
Yep.
And if we haven't been through it personally, I've been through it with someone else. I've seen how this stuff plays out and so has Paige, and we'll work you through that. You will also get updates to the course. Like I'm a firm believer that there's no such thing as perfect.
Yeah. There can be updates, changes, anything. And that's what's pretty cool about the way that we set it up is that anytime there is an update, you are going to get access to that.
Yeah. So add a module, add a section, whatever it might be, worksheets, exercises. You'll get access to those too for forever into perpetuity. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty cool. I think it's, I mean, I don't know. It's the cost of like a handful of sessions of therapy if you're paying out of pocket.
Yeah.
And it's a lifetime access to not only the course, but us. And it's unlike anything else that's out there. Mm-hmm. People that are taking it are saying like this sped up what I went through. Because we've had people take it at different stages. And like, let's talk about that for just a second.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There are people who are taking it when their partner is still in active addiction. Someone who is in early recovery and even... someone who is has been removed from their life.
Yeah, for quite some time. So it's like
for quite some time, and they're all gaining something from the course. There's something in it for everybody.
There is. So it's not just about how to rebuild your marriage.
No.
I do even think that if I'm an addict and I'm sitting there, I can listen to this and be like, oh, I absolutely agree. And I've even told addicts before, like I've had people that approach me and like, hey, I'm interested. Like my wife's interested in the course. What do you think about it? I'm like, I'm just going to let you know, it's going to empower her. Which means that there's no more, you can't F up anymore.
Right.
Like there's no more. Like once she's educated on this and she's empowered.
Yep. And she's able to set boundaries. Like,
you better be serious about this.
Mm-hmm.
And if you, that's the only way to be though.
Yep.
That's the only way to be.
It is.
It just, if it does anything at all, it's an added layer of accountability.
Yes. I agree. 100%.
I think it's good for recovery.
I think it is too.
I think it's bad for people that want to get away with something. I think it's bad for people that aren't ready. I think it's bad for people that want to try and pull the wool over your eyes. But for people that are serious about recovery, I think it's very beneficial.
Yep.
And I'd stand by that all day, every day.
Yes.
So, yeah. So it's no matter where you're at, it's beneficial.
Agreed.
So I think that's all we have.
Yes.
Was there anything else on this?
No.
This
no.
Ambiguous loss?
I think we hit all the points.
I think so too. So it's not just sadness. It is a state of yearning and desire. And it's not just regular grief.
Right. And I did want to say that sometimes therapists will, what we read is that some therapists diagnose people with depression when in reality they are just dealing with,
people will get
complicated
diagnosed
with
MDD, with major depressive disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And because there, I think there's 11 criteria and once you meet five of them, a medical professional, you know, a licensed professional can say, it sounds to me like you have MDD.
Mm-hmm.
Like true medical depression. What they caution against is you have to identify the type of loss.
Yeah.
It's not just all loss. You can't just throw grief in this bucket and say, that's just grief.
Mm-hmm.
And since you've been dealing with it for longer than 6 months, it sounds like depression.
Mm-hmm.
The context matters. Like we always say that.
Yes. The context matters.
Absolutely. Context matters. So Yeah, we're all about skills before pills. I mean, certainly right. there is a place for medications and things like
oh,
that.
Oh, yeah, in life, yeah. But we've been open about that. So.
Yeah, but
I just wanted to throw that out there because I thought it was really interesting when I
important.
Read about that.
And we'll link these articles so you can read through them as well.
Yep.
And get educated.
Yeah.
Let's wake up together.
Yay.
All right, well, that's all we got. Until next time, I'm Matt.
I'm Paige.
And we'll see you.
Bye.